This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Shadow and Bone, written by Lee Bardugo, narrated by Lauren Fortgang.
Before. The servants called them Malenchki, little ghosts, because they were the smallest and the youngest, and because they haunted the Duke's house like giggling phantoms, darting in and out of rooms, hiding in cupboards to eavesdrop, sneaking into the kitchen to steal the last of the summer peaches. The boy and the girl had arrived within weeks of each other, two more orphans of the border wars, dirty-faced refugees plucked from the rubble of distant towns and brought to the Duke's estate to learn to read and write, and to learn a trade. The boy was short and stocky, shy but always smiling. The girl was different, and she knew it. Huddled in the kitchen cupboard, listening to the grown-ups' gossip, she heard the Duke's housekeeper, Anna Kuya, say, "She's an ugly little thing. No child should look like that. Pale and sour, like a glass of milk that's turned." "And so skinny," the cook replied. "Never finishes her supper." Crouched beside the girl, the boy turned to her and whispered, "Why don't you eat?"
"Because everything she cooks tastes like mud."
"Tastes fine to me."
"You'll eat anything."
They bent their ears back to the crack in the cupboard doors. A moment later, the boy whispered, "I don't think you're ugly."
"Shh,"
the girl hissed. But hidden by the deep shadows of the cupboard, she smiled. In the summer, they endured long hours of chores, followed by even longer hours of lessons in stifling classrooms. When the heat was at its worst, they escaped into the woods to hunt for birds' nests, or swim in the muddy little creek, or they would lie for hours in their meadow, watching the sun pass slowly overhead, speculating on where they would build their dairy farm and whether they would have two white cows or three. In the winter, the Duke left for his city house in Os Alta, and as the days grew shorter and colder, the teachers grew lax in their duties, preferring to sit by the fire and play cards, or drink kvass. Bored and trapped indoors, the older children doled out more frequent beatings. So the boy and the girl hid in the disused rooms of the estate, putting on plays for the mice, and trying to keep warm. On the day the Grisha examiners came, the boy and the girl were perched in the window seat of a dusty upstairs bedroom, hoping to catch a glimpse of the mail coach. Instead, they saw a sleigh, a troika, pulled by three black horses, passed through the white stone gates onto the estate. They watched its silent progress through the snow to the Duke's front door. Three figures emerged in elegant fur hats and heavy wool kefta, one in crimson, one in darkest blue, and one in vibrant purple.
"Grisha,"
the girl whispered.
"Quick,"
said the boy. In an instant, they had shaken off their shoes and were running slowly down the hall, slipping through the empty music room and darting behind a column in the gallery that overlooked the sitting room where Anna Kuya liked to receive guests. Anna Kuya was already there, bird-like in her black dress, pouring tea from the samovar, her large keyring jangling at her waist.
"There are just the two this year, then?" said a woman's low voice.
They peered through the railings of the balcony to the room below. Two of the Grisha sat by the fire, a handsome man in blue, and a woman in red robes with a haughty, refined air. The third, a young blonde man, ambled about the room, stretching his legs.
"Yes," said Anna Kuya. "A boy and a girl, the youngest here by quite a bit, both around eight, we think."
"You think?" asked the man in blue.
"When the parents are deceased."
"We understand," said the woman. "We are, of course, great admirers of your institution. We only wish more of the nobility took an interest in the common people."
"Our Duke is a very great man," said Anna Kuya.
Up in the balcony, the boy and the girl nodded sagely to each other. Their benefactor, Duke Kerimsov, was a celebrated war hero, and a friend to the people. When he had returned from the front lines, he converted his estate into an orphanage and a home for war widows. They were told to keep him nightly in their prayers.
"And what are they like, these children?" asked the woman.
"The girl has some talent for drawing. The boy is most at home in the meadow and the wood."
"But what are they like?" repeated the woman.
Anakuya pursed her withered lips.
"What are they like? They are undisciplined, contrary, far too attached to each other. They
are listening to every word we say," said the young man in purple.
The boy and the girl jumped in surprise. He was staring directly at their hiding spot. They shrank behind the column, but it was too late. Anakuya's voice lashed out like a whip.
"Alina Starkov! Melyen Oretsev! Come down here at once!"
Reluctantly, Alina and Mal made their way down the narrow spiral staircase at the end of the gallery. When they reached the bottom, the woman in red rose from her chair and gestured them forward.
"Do you know who we are?"
the woman asked. Her hair was steel gray, her face lined but beautiful.
"You're witches,"
blurted Mal.
"Witches?" she snarled.
She whirled on Anakuya.
"Is that what you teach at this school? Superstition and lies?"
Anakuya flushed with embarrassment. The woman in red turned back to Mal and Alina, her dark eyes blazing.
"We are not witches. We are practitioners of the small science. We keep this country and this kingdom safe."
"As does the First Army,"
Anakuya said quietly, an unmistakable edge to her voice. The woman in red stiffened, but after a moment she conceded.
"As does the King's Army."
The young man in purple smiled and knelt before the children. He said gently,
"When the leaves change color, do you call it magic? What about when you cut your hand and it heals? And when you put a pot of water on the stove and it boils, is it magic then?"
Mal shook his head, his eyes wide. But Alina frowned and said, "Anyone can boil water." Anakuya sighed in exasperation, but the woman in red laughed.
"You're very right. Anyone can boil water.
But not just anyone can master the small science. That's why we've come to test you."
She turned to Anakuya.
"Leave us now."
"Wait!"
exclaimed Mal.
"What happens if we're Grisha? What happens to us?"
The woman in red looked down at them.
"If, by some small chance, one of you is Grisha, then that lucky child will go to a special school where Grisha learn to use their talents. You will have the finest clothes, the finest food, whatever your heart desires," said the man in purple. "Would you like that?"
"It is the greatest way that you may serve your king,"
said Anakuya, still hovering by the door.
"That is very true," said the woman in red, pleased and willing to make peace.
The boy and the girl glanced at each other, and because the adults were not paying close attention, they did not see the girl reach out to clasp the boy's hand, or the look that passed between them. The Duke would have recognized that look. He had spent long years on the ravaged northern borders, where the villagers were constantly under siege, and the peasants fought their battles with little aid from the king or anyone else. He had seen a woman, barefoot and unflinching in her doorway, face down a row of bayonets. He knew the look of a man defending his home, with nothing but a rock in his hand. Chapter 1. Standing on the edge of a crowded road, I looked down onto the rolling fields and abandoned farms of the Tula Valley and got my first glimpse of the Shadow Fold. My regiment was 2 weeks' march from the military encampment at Politsnaya, and the autumn sun was warm overhead, but I shivered in my coat as I eyed the haze that lay like a dirty smudge on the horizon. A heavy shoulder slammed into me from behind. I stumbled and nearly pitched face first into the muddy road.
"Hey!"
shouted the soldier.
"Watch yourself!"
"Why don't you watch your fat feet?" I snapped, and took some satisfaction from the surprise that came over his broad face. People, particularly big men carrying big rifles, don't expect lip from a scrawny thing like me. They always look a bit dazed when they get it. The soldier got over the novelty quickly and gave me a dirty look as he adjusted the pack on his back, then disappeared into the caravan of horses, men, carts, and wagons, streaming over the crest of the hill and into the valley below. I quickened my steps, trying to peer over the crowd. I'd lost sight of the yellow flag of the surveyor's cart hours ago, and I knew I was far behind. As I walked, I took in the green and gold smells of the autumn wood, the soft breeze at my back. We were on the Vi, the wide road that had once led all the way from Os Alta to the wealthy port cities on Ravka's western coast. But that was before the Shadow Fold. Somewhere in the crowd, someone was singing. Singing? What idiot is singing on his way into the fold? I glanced again at that smudge on the horizon and had to suppress a shudder. I'd seen the Shadow Fold on many maps, a black slash that had severed Ravka from its only coastline and left it landlocked. Sometimes it was shown as a stain, sometimes as a bleak and shapeless cloud, and then there were the maps that just showed the Shadow Fold as a long, narrow lake and labeled it by its other name, the Unsea, a name intended to put soldiers and merchants at their ease and encourage crossings. I snorted. That might fool some fat merchant, but it was little comfort to me. I tore my attention from the sinister haze hovering in the distance and looked down onto the ruined farms of the Tula. The valley had once been home to some of Ravka's richest estates. One day it was a place where farmers tended crops and sheep grazed in green fields. The next, a dark slash had appeared on the landscape, a swath of nearly impenetrable darkness that grew with every passing year and crawled with horrors. Where the farmers had gone, their herds, their crops, their homes and families, no one knew. "Stop it," I told myself firmly. "You're only making things worse. People have been crossing the fold for years, usually with massive casualties, but all the same." I took a deep breath to steady myself. "No fainting in the middle of the road," said a voice close to my ear as a heavy arm landed across my shoulders and gave me a squeeze. I looked up to see Mal's familiar face, a smile in his bright blue eyes as he fell into step beside me. "Come on," he said. "One foot in front of the other. You know how it's done." "You're interfering with my plan."
"Oh, really?"
"Yes. Faint, get trampled, grievous injuries all around."
"That sounds like a brilliant plan."
"Ah, but if I'm horribly maimed, I won't be able to cross the fold." Mal nodded slowly.
"I see. I can shove you under a cart, if that would help."
"I'll think about it," I grumbled. But I felt my mood lifting all the same. Despite my best efforts, Mal still had that effect on me. And I wasn't the only one. A pretty blonde girl strolled by and waved, throwing Mal a flirtatious glance over her shoulder.
"Hey, Ruby,"
he called.
"See you later."
Ruby giggled and scampered off into the crowd. Mal grinned broadly until he caught my eye roll.
"What? I thought you liked Ruby."
"As it happens, we don't have much to talk about," I said dryly. I actually had liked Ruby, at first. When Mal and I left the orphanage at Keremsin to travel for our military service in Politsnaya, I'd been nervous about meeting new people. But lots of girls had been excited to befriend me, and Ruby had been among the most eager. Those friendships lasted as long as it took me to figure out that their only interest in me lay in my proximity to Mal. Now I watched him stretch his arms expansively and turn his face up to the autumn sky, looking perfectly content. There was even, I noted with some disgust, a little bounce in his step. "What is wrong with you?" I whispered furiously.
"Nothing," he said, surprised. "I feel great."
"But how can you be so...
so jaunty. Jaunty? I have never been jaunty. I hope never to be jaunty.
Well, then, what's all this?
I asked, waving a hand at him.
You look like you're on your way to a really good dinner, instead of possible death and dismemberment.
Mal laughed. You worry too much. The king sent a whole group of Grisha Pyros to cover the skiffs, and even a few of those creepy heart renders. We have our rifles, he said, patting the one on his back. We'll be fine.
A rifle won't make much difference if there's a bad attack.
Mal gave me a bemused glance. What's with you lately?
You're even grumpier than usual, and you look terrible.
Thanks, I groused. I haven't been sleeping well.
What else is new?
He was right, of course. I'd never slept well, but it had been even worse over the last few days. Saints knew I had plenty of good reasons to dread going into the fold, reasons shared by every member of our regiment who had been unlucky enough to be chosen for the crossing. But there was something else, a deeper feeling of unease that I couldn't quite name. I glanced at Mal. There had been a time when I could have told him anything. I just have this feeling.
Stop worrying so much. Maybe they'll put Mikhail on the skiff. The Volgra will take one look at all that big, juicy belly of his and leave us alone.
Unbidden, a memory came to me. Mal and I sitting side by side in a chair in the Duke's library, flipping through the pages of a large leather-bound book. We'd happened on an illustration of a Volgra, long, filthy claws, leathery wings, and rows of razor-sharp teeth for feasting on human flesh. They were blind from generations spent living and hunting in the fold, but legend had it, they could smell human blood from miles away. I'd pointed to the page and asked, "What is it holding?" I could still hear Mal's whisper in my ear. I think it's a foot. We'd slammed the book shut and run squealing out into the safety of the sunlight. Without realizing it, I'd stopped walking, frozen in place, unable to shake the memory from my mind. When Mal realized I wasn't with him, he gave a great, beleaguered sigh and marched back to me. He rested his hands on my shoulders and gave me a little shake.
I was kidding. No one's going to eat Mikhail.
I know, I said, staring down at my boots. You're hilarious.
Alina, come on, we'll be fine.
You can't know that.
Look at me.
I willed myself to raise my eyes to his.
I know you're scared. I am too. But we're going to do this, and we're going to be fine. We always are. Okay?
He smiled, and my heart gave a very loud thud in my chest. I rubbed my thumb over the scar that ran across the palm of my right hand and took a shaky breath. Okay, I said grudgingly. And I actually felt myself smiling back.
Madame's spirits have been restored, Mal shouted. The sun can once more shine.
Oh, will you shut up?
I turned to give him a punch, but before I could, he had grabbed hold of me and lifted me off my feet. A clatter of hooves and shouts split the air. Mal yanked me to the side of the road just as a huge black coach roared past, scattering people before it as they ran to avoid the pounding hooves of four black horses. Beside the whip-wielding driver perched two soldiers in charcoal coats. The Darkling. There was no mistaking his black coach or the uniform of his personal guard. Another coach, this one lacquered red, rumbled past us at a more leisurely pace. I looked up at Mal, my heart racing from the close call.
Thanks, I whispered.
Mal suddenly seemed to realize that he had his arms around me. He let go and hastily stepped back. I brushed the dust from my coat, hoping he wouldn't notice the flush on my cheeks. A third coach rolled by, lacquered in blue, and a girl leaned out the window. She had curling black hair and wore a hat of silver fox. She scanned the watching crowd, and predictably, her eyes lingered on Mal. You were just mooning over him, I chided myself,
Why shouldn't some gorgeous Grisha do the same?
Her lips curled into a small smile as she held Mal's gaze, watching him over her shoulder until the coach was out of sight.
Mal goggled dumbly after her, his mouth slightly open.
"Close your mouth before something flies in," I snapped.
Mal blinked, still looking dazed.
"Did you see that?"
a voice bellowed. I turned to see Mikhail loping toward us, wearing an almost comical expression of awe. Mikhail was a huge redhead with a wide face and an even wider neck. Behind him, Dubrov, Reedy and Dark, hurried to catch up. They were both trackers in Mal's unit, and never far from his side.
"Of course I saw it,"
Mal said, his dopey expression evaporating into a cocky grin. I rolled my eyes.
"She looked right at you,"
shouted Mikhail, clapping Mal on the back. Mal gave a casual shrug, but his smile widened.
"So she did," he said smugly.
Dubrov shifted nervously.
"They say Grisha girls can put spells on you."
I snorted. Mikhail looked at me as if he hadn't even known I was there.
"Taste dicks,"
he said, and gave me a little jab on the arm. I scowled at the nickname, but he had already turned back to Mal.
"You know, she'll be staying at camp," he said with a leer.
"I hear the Grisha tent's as big as a cathedral," added Dubrov.
"Lots of nice shadowy nooks," said Mikhail,
and actually waggled his brows. Mal whooped. Without sparing me another glance, the three of them strode off, shouting and shoving one another.
"Great seeing you guys," I muttered under my breath. I readjusted the strap of the satchel slung across my shoulders and started back down the road, joining the last few stragglers down the hill and into Krivirsk. I didn't bother to hurry. I'd probably get yelled at when I finally made it to the documents tent, but there was nothing I could do about it now. I rubbed my arm where Mikhail had punched me. Styx. I hated that name.
You didn't call me Styx when you were drunk on kvass and trying to paw me at the spring bonfire, you miserable oaf, I thought spitefully.
Krivirsk wasn't much to look at. According to the senior cartographer, it had been a sleepy market town in the days before the Shadow Fold, little more than a dusty main square, and an inn for weary travelers on the Vi. But now it had become a kind of ramshackle port city, growing up around a permanent military encampment, and the dry docks where the sand skiffs waited to take passengers through the darkness to Westravka. I passed taverns and pubs and what I was pretty sure were brothels meant to cater to the troops of the king's army. There were shops selling rifles and crossbows, lamps and torches, all necessary equipment for a trek across the fold. The little church with its whitewashed walls and gleaming onion domes was in surprisingly good repair. Or maybe not so surprising, I considered. Anyone contemplating a trip across the Shadow Fold would be smart to stop and pray. I found my way to where the surveyors were billeted, deposited my pack on a cot, and hurried over to the documents tent. To my relief, the senior cartographer was nowhere in sight, and I was able to slip inside unseen. Entering the white canvas tent, I felt myself relax for the first time since I'd caught sight of the fold. The documents tent was essentially the same in every camp I'd seen, full of bright light and rows of drafting tables where artists and surveyors bent to their work. After the noise and jostle of the journey, there was something soothing about the crackle of paper, the smell of ink, and the soft scratching of nibs and brushes. I pulled my sketchbook from my coat pocket and slid onto a workbench beside Alexei, who turned to me and whispered irritably,
"Where have you been?"
"Nearly getting trampled by the Darkling's coach," I replied, grabbing a clean piece of paper and flipping through my sketches to try to find a suitable one to copy. Alexei and I were both junior cartographer's assistants, and, as part of our training, we had to submit 2 finished sketches, or renderings, at the end of every day. Alexei drew in a sharp breath.
"Really? Did you actually see him?"
"Actually, I was too busy trying not to die,"
There are worse ways to go.
He caught sight of the sketch of a rocky valley I was about to start copying.
Oh, not that one.
He flipped through my sketchbook to an elevation of a mountain ridge and tapped it with his finger.
There.
I barely had time to put pen to paper before the senior cartographer entered the tent and came swooping down the aisle, observing our work as he passed.
I hope that's the second sketch you're starting, Alina Starkov.
Yes,
I lied.
Yes, it is.
As soon as the cartographer had passed on, Alexei whispered,
Tell me about the coach. I have to finish my sketches. Here,
he said in exasperation, sliding one of his sketches over to me. He'll know it's your work.
It's not that good. You should be able to pass it off as yours.
Now there's the Alexei I know and tolerate, I grumbled. But I didn't give back the sketch. Alexei was one of the most talented assistants, and he knew it. Alexei extracted every last detail from me about the three Grisha coaches. I was grateful for the sketch, so I did my best to satisfy his curiosity as I finished up my elevation of the mountain ridge and worked in my thumb measurements of some of the highest peaks. By the time we were finished, dusk was falling. We handed in our work and walked to the mess tent, where we stood in line for muddy stew ladled out by a sweaty cook, and found seats with some of the other surveyors. I passed the meal in silence, listening to Alexei and the others exchange camp gossip and jittery talk about tomorrow's crossing. Alexei insisted that I retell the story of the Grisha coaches, and it was met by the usual mix of fascination and fear that greeted any mention of the Darkling.
He's not natural, said Eva, another assistant.
She had pretty green eyes that did little to distract from her pig-like nose.
None of them are.
Alexei sniffed.
Please, spare us your superstition, Eva.
It was a Darkling who made the Shadow Fold to begin with.
That was hundreds of years ago, protested Alexei. And that Darkling was completely mad.
This one is just as bad.
Peasant,
Alexei said, and dismissed her with a wave. Eva gave him an affronted look and deliberately turned away from him to talk to her friends. I stayed quiet. I was more a peasant than Eva, despite her superstitions. It was only by the Duke's charity that I could read and write, but by unspoken agreement, Mal and I avoided mentioning Kerimsen. As if on cue, a raucous burst of laughter pulled me from my thoughts. I looked over my shoulder. Mal was holding court at a rowdy table of trackers. Alexei followed my glance.
How did you two become friends, anyway?
We grew up together.
You don't seem to have much in common.
I shrugged.
I guess it's easy to have a lot in common when you're kids.
Like loneliness and memories of parents we were meant to forget. And the pleasure of escaping chores to play tag in our meadow. Alexei looked so skeptical that I had to laugh.
He wasn't always the amazing Mal, expert tracker and seducer of Grisha girls.
Alexei's jaw dropped.
He seduced a Grisha girl?
No, but I'm sure he will, I muttered.
So what was he like?
He was short and pudgy and afraid of baths, I said. With some satisfaction. Alexei glanced at Mal.
I guess things change.
I rubbed my thumb over the scar in my palm.
I guess they do.
We cleared our plates and drifted out of the mess tent into the cool night. On the way back to the barracks, we took a detour so that we could walk by the Grisha camp. The Grisha pavilion really was the size of a cathedral covered in black silk. Its blue, red, and purple pennants flying high above. Hidden somewhere behind it were the Darkling's tents, guarded by Corporal Kai Heartrenders and the Darkling's personal guard. When Alexei had looked his fill, we wended our way back to our quarters. Alexei got quiet and started cracking his knuckles, and I knew we were both thinking about tomorrow's crossing. Judging by the gloomy mood in the barracks, we weren't alone. Some people were already on their cots, sleeping, or trying to, while others huddled by lamplight, talking in low tones. A few sat clutching their icons, praying to their saints. I unfurled my bedroll on a narrow cot, removed my boots, and hung up my coat. Then I wriggled down into the fur-lined blankets and stared up at the roof, waiting for sleep. I stayed that way for a long time until the lamplights had all been extinguished, and the sounds of conversation gave way to soft snores and the rustle of bodies. Tomorrow, if everything went as planned, we would pass safely through to West Ravka, and I would get my first glimpse of the true sea. There, Mal and the other trackers would hunt for red wolves and sea foxes and other coveted creatures that could only be found in the West. I would stay with the cartographers in Oskervo to finish my training and help draft whatever information we managed to glean in the fold. And then, of course, I'd have to cross the fold again in order to return home. But it was hard to think that far ahead. I was still wide awake when I heard it. Tap, tap. Pause. Tap. Then again. Tap, tap. Pause. Tap.
"What's going on?"
mumbled Alexei drowsily from the cot nearest mine.
"Nothing,"
I whispered, already slipping out of my bedroll and shoving my feet into my boots.
I grabbed my coat and crept out of the barracks as quietly as I could.
As I opened the door, I heard a giggle and a female voice called from somewhere in the dark room.
"If it's that tracker, tell him to come inside and keep me warm.
If he wants to catch Syphil, I'm sure you'll be his first stop," I said sweetly, and slipped out into the night. The cold air stung my cheeks, and I buried my chin in my collar, wishing I'd taken the time to grab my scarf and gloves. Mal was sitting on the rickety steps, his back to me. Beyond him, I could see Mikhail and Dubrov passing a bottle back and forth beneath the glowing lights of the footpath. I scowled. "Please tell me you didn't just wake me up to inform me that you're going to the Grisha tent. What do you want, advice?"
"You weren't sleeping. You were lying awake, worrying."
"Wrong. I was planning how to sneak into the Grisha pavilion and snag myself a cute corporalnik." Mal laughed. I hesitated by the door. This was the hardest part of being around him, other than the way he made my heart do clumsy acrobatics. I hated hiding how much the stupid things he did hurt me, but I hated the idea of him finding out even more. I thought about just turning around and going back inside. Instead, I swallowed my jealousy and sat down beside him. "I hope you brought me something nice," I said. "Alina's secrets of seduction do not come cheap." He grinned.
"Can you put it on my tab?"
"I suppose, but only because I know you're good for it." I peered into the dark and watched Dubrov take a swig from the bottle, and then lurch forward. Mikhail put his arm out to steady him, and the sounds of their laughter floated back to us on the night air. Mal shook his head and sighed.
"He always tries to keep up with Mikhail. He'll probably end up puking on my boots."
"Serves you right," I said. "So what are you doing here?" When we'd first started our military service a year ago, Mal had visited me almost every night, but he hadn't come by in months. He shrugged.
"I don't know. You looked so miserable at dinner."
I was surprised he'd noticed. "Just thinking about the crossing," I said carefully. It wasn't exactly a lie. I was terrified of entering the fold, and Mal definitely didn't need to know that Alexei and I had been talking about him. "But I'm touched by your concern."
"Hey," he said with a grin, "I worry.
If you're lucky, a Volcra will have me for breakfast tomorrow, and then you won't have to fret anymore.
You know I'd be lost without you."
"You've never been lost in your life," I scoffed. I was the mapmaker, but Mal could find True North blindfolded and standing on his head. He bumped his shoulder against mine.
"You know what I mean."
"Sure," I said. But I didn't. Not really. We sat in silence, watching our breath make plumes in the cold air. Mal studied the toes of his boots and said,
"I guess I'm nervous, too."
I nudged him with my elbow and said with confidence I didn't feel, "If we can take on Anakuya, we can handle a few Volcra."
If I remember right, the last time we crossed Anacuya, you got your ears boxed and we both ended up mucking out the stables. I winced.
I'm trying to be reassuring. You could at least pretend I'm succeeding.
You know the funny thing? He asked. I actually miss her sometimes. I did my best to hide my astonishment. We'd spent more than 10 years of our lives in Kremzin, but I usually got the impression that Mal wanted to forget everything about the place, maybe even me. There he'd been another lost refugee, another orphan made to feel grateful for every mouthful of food, every used pair of boots. In the army, he'd carved out a real place for himself where no one needed to know that he'd once been an unwanted little boy.
Me too, I admitted. We could write to her.
Maybe, Mal said. Suddenly he reached out and took hold of my hand. I tried to ignore the little jolt that went through me. This time tomorrow, we'll be sitting in the harbor at Oskirvo, looking out at the ocean and drinking kvass. I glanced at Dubrov, weaving back and forth, and smiled.
Is Dubrov buying?
Just you and me, Mal said.
Really?
It's always just you and me, Alina.
For a moment, it seemed like it was true. The world was this step, this circle of lamplight, the two of us suspended in the dark.
Come on! Bellowed Mikhail from the path.
Mal started like a man waking from a dream. He gave my hand a last squeeze before he dropped it.
Gotta go,
he said, his brash grin sliding back into place.
Try to get some sleep.
He hopped lightly from the stairs and jogged off to join his friends.
Wish me luck,
he called over his shoulder.
Good luck, I said automatically, and then wanted to kick myself.
Good luck? Have a lovely time, Mal. Hope you find a pretty Grisha, fall deeply in love, and make lots of gorgeous, disgustingly talented babies together. I sat frozen on the steps, watching them disappear down the path, still feeling the warm pressure of Mal's hand in mine. Oh well, I thought as I got to my feet. Maybe he'll fall into a ditch on his way there. I edged back into the barracks, closed the door tightly behind me, and gratefully snuggled into my bedroll. Would that black-haired Grisha girl sneak out of the pavilion to meet Mal? I pushed the thought away. It was none of my business, and really I didn't want to know. Mal had never looked at me the way he'd looked at that girl, or even the way he looked at Ruby, and he never would. But the fact that we were still friends was more important than any of that. For how long? Said a nagging voice in my head. Alexei was right. Things change. Mal had changed for the better. He'd gotten handsomer, braver, cockier, and I'd gotten taller. I sighed and rolled onto my side. I wanted to believe that Mal and I would always be friends, but I had to face the fact that we were on different paths. Lying in the dark, waiting for sleep, I wondered if those paths would just keep taking us further and further apart, and if a day might come when we would be strangers to each other once again.
Chapter 2 The morning passed in a blur. Breakfast, a brief trip to the documents tent to pack additional inks and papers, then the chaos of the dry dock. I stood with the rest of the surveyors, waiting our turn to board one of a small fleet of sand skiffs. Behind us, Krybirsk was waking up and going about its business. Ahead lay the strange, shifting darkness of the fold. Animals were too noisy and scared too easily for travel on the unsea, so crossings were made on sand skiffs. Shallow sleds rigged with enormous sails that let them skate almost soundlessly over the dead gray sands. The skiffs were loaded with grain, timber, and raw cotton, but on the trip back they would be stocked with sugar, rifles, and all manner of finished goods that passed through the seaports of West Ravka. Looking out at the skiff's deck, equipped with little more than a sail and a rickety sailing, all I could think was that it offered no place to hide. At the mast of each sled, flanked by heavily armed soldiers, stood two Grisha Ethereal Kai, the Order of Summoners, in dark blue kefta. The silver embroidery at their cuffs and the hems of their robes indicated that they were squallers, Grisha who could raise or lower the pressure of the air and fill the skiff's sails with wind that would carry us across the long miles of the fold. Soldiers armed with rifles and overseen by a grim officer lined the railings. Between them stood more Ethereali, but their blue robes bore the red cuffs that indicated they could raise fire. At a signal from the skiff's captain, the senior cartographer herded me, Alexei, and the rest of the assistants onto the skiff to join the other passengers. Then he took his place beside the squallers at the mast, where he would help them navigate through the dark. He had a compass in his hand, but it would be of little use once we were on the fold. As we crowded on deck, I caught a glimpse of Mal standing with the trackers on the other side of the skiff. They were also armed with rifles. A row of archers stood behind them, the quivers on their backs, bristling with arrows tipped in Grisha's steel. I fingered the hilt of the army-issued knife tucked into my belt. It didn't give me much confidence. A shout rang out from the foreman on the docks, and crews of burly men on the ground began pushing the skiffs into the colorless sand that marked the farthest reaches of the fold. They stepped back hurriedly, as if that pale, dead sand would burn their feet. Then it was our turn, and with a sudden jolt, our skiff lurched forward, creaking against the earth as the dock workers heaved. I grabbed the railing to steady myself, my heart beating wildly. The squallers lifted their arms, the sails billowed open with a loud snap, and our skiff surged forward into the fold. At first, it was like drifting into a thick cloud of smoke, but there was no heat, no smell of fire. Sounds seemed to dampen and the world became still. I watched the sand skiffs ahead of us slide into the darkness, fading from view, one after another. I realized that I could no longer see the prow of our skiff, and then that I could not see my own hand on the railing. I looked back over my shoulder. The living world had disappeared. Darkness fell around us, black, weightless, and absolute. We were in the fold. It was like standing at the end of everything. I held tight to the railing, feeling the wood dig into my hand, grateful for its solidity. I focused on that and the feel of my toes in my boots gripping the deck. To my left, I could hear Alexei breathing. I tried to think about the soldiers with their rifles and the blue-robed Grisha pyros. The hope in crossing the fold was that we would pass through silently and unnoticed. No shot would sound, no fire would be summoned. But their presence comforted me all the same. I don't know how long we went on that way, the skiffs floating forward, the only sound the gentle rasp of sand on their hulls. It seemed like minutes, but it might have been hours. We're going to be okay, I thought to myself. We are going to be okay. Then I felt Alexei's hand fumbling for mine. He seized hold of my wrist. Listen, he whispered, and his voice was hoarse with terror. For a moment all I heard was his ragged breathing and the steady hiss of the skiff. Then, somewhere out in the darkness, another sound, faint but relentless, the rhythmic flapping of wings. I grabbed Alexei's arm with one hand and clutched the hilt of my knife with the other, my heart pounding, my eyes straining to see something, anything in the blackness. I heard the sound of triggers being cocked, the tap of arrows being notched. Someone whispered, "Be ready." We waited, listening to the sound of wings beating in the air, growing louder as they drew nearer, like the drums of an oncoming army. I thought I could feel the wind stir against my cheek as they circled closer, closer. "Burn!" the command rang out, followed by the crackle of flint striking stone and an explosive whoosh as rippling blooms of Grisha flame erupted from each of the skiffs. I squinted into the sudden brightness, waiting for my vision to adjust. In the firelight, I saw them. Volkra were supposed to move in small flocks, but there they were, not tens, but hundreds, hovering and swooping in the air around the skiff. They were more frightening than anything I had ever seen in any book, than any monster I could have imagined. Shots rang out, the archers let fly, and the shrieks of Volcra split the air high and horrible. They dove. I heard a shrill wail and watched in horror as a soldier was lifted from his feet and carried into the air, kicking and struggling. Alexei and I huddled together, crouched low against the railing, clinging to our flimsy knives and muttering our prayers as the world dissolved into nightmare. All around us, men shouted. People screamed. Soldiers were locked in combat with the massive, writhing forms of winged beasts. And the unnatural darkness of the fold was broken in fits and starts by bursts of golden Grisha flame. Then a cry rent the air beside me. I gasped as Alexei's arm was yanked from mine. In a spurt of flame, I saw him clutching at the railing with one hand. I saw his howling mouth, his wide, terrified eyes, and the monstrous thing that held him in its glistening gray arms, its wings beating the air as it lifted him from his feet, its thick claws sunk deep into his back, its talons already wet with his blood. Alexei's fingers slipped on the railing. I lunged forward and grabbed his arm. "Hold on!" I cried. Then the flame vanished, and in the darkness I felt Alexei's fingers pulled from mine. "Alexei!" I shouted. His screams faded into the sounds of battle as the Volcra carried him into the dark. Another burst of flame lit the sky, but he was gone. "Alexei!" I yelled, leaning over the side of the railing. "Alexei!" The answer came in a gust of wings as another Volcra swooped down on me. I careened backward, barely avoiding its grasp, my knife held out before me with trembling hands. The Volcra lunged forward, the firelight glinting off its milky, sightless eyes, its gaping mouth crowded with rows of sharp, crooked black teeth. I saw a flash of powder from the corner of my eye, heard a rifle shot, and the Volcra stumbled, yowling in rage and pain. "Move!" It was Mal, rifle in hand, face streaked with blood. He grabbed my arm and pulled me behind him. The Volcra was still coming, clawing its way across the deck, one of its wings hanging at a crooked angle. Mal was trying to reload in the firelight, but the Volcra was too fast. It rushed at us, claws slashing, its talons tearing across Mal's chest. He screamed in pain. I grabbed hold of the Volcra's broken wing and stabbed my knife deep between its shoulders. Its muscled flesh felt slimy beneath my hands. It screeched and thrashed free of my grip, and I fell backward, hitting the deck hard. It lunged at me in a frenzy of rage, its huge jaws snapping. Another shot rang out. The Volcra stumbled and fell in a grotesque heap, black blood pouring from its mouth. In the dim light, I saw Mal lowering his rifle. His torn shirt was dark with blood. The rifle slid from his fingers as he swayed and fell to his knees, then collapsed onto the deck. "Mal!" I was at his side in an instant, my hands pressing down on his chest in a desperate attempt to stop the bleeding. "Mal!" I sobbed, the tears streaming down my cheeks. The air was thick with the smell of blood and gunpowder. All around us I heard rifle fire, people weeping, and the obscene sound of something feeding. The flames of the Grisha were growing weaker, more sporadic, and worst of all, I realized the skiff had stopped moving. "This is it," I thought hopelessly. I bent low over Mal, keeping pressure on the wound. His breathing was labored. "They're coming," he gasped. I looked up and saw, in the feeble, fading glow of Grisha fire, two Volcra swooping down upon us. I huddled over Mal, shielding his body with mine. I knew it was futile, but it was all I could offer. I smelled the fetid stench of the Volcra, felt the air gusting from their wings. I pressed my forehead to Mal's and heard him whisper, "I'll meet you in the meadow." Something inside me gave way. In fury, in hopelessness, in the certainty of my own death,
I felt Mal's blood beneath my palms, saw the pain in his beloved face. A Volcra screeched in triumph as its talons sank into my shoulder. Pain shot through my body. And the world went white. I closed my eyes as a sudden, piercing flood of light exploded across my vision. It seemed to fill my head, blinding me, drowning me. From somewhere above, I heard a horrible shriek. I felt the Volcra's claws loosen their grip, felt the thud as I fell forward and my head connected with the deck. And then I felt nothing at all. Chapter 3. I woke with a start. I could feel the rush of air on my skin, and I opened my eyes to see what looked like dark clouds of smoke. I was on my back on the deck of the skiff. It took me only a moment to realize that the clouds were getting thinner, giving way to dark wisps, and between them a bright autumn sun. I closed my eyes again, feeling relief wash over me. "We're on our way out of the fold," I thought. Somehow we made it through. Or had we? Memories of the Volcra attack flooded back to me in a frightening rush. Where was Mal? I tried to sit up, and a bolt of pain shot through my shoulders. I ignored it and pushed myself up. I found myself looking down a rifle barrel. "Get that thing away from me," I snapped, batting it aside. The soldier swung the rifle back around, jabbing it threateningly at me.
"Stay where you are," he commanded.
I stared at him, stunned. "What's wrong with you?"
"She's awake,"
he shouted over his shoulder. He was joined by two more armed soldiers, the captain of the skiff and a korporalnik. With a thrum of panic, I saw that the cuffs of her red kefta were embroidered in black. What did a heartrender want with me? I looked around. A squaller still stood by the mast, arms raised, driving us forward on a strong wind, a single soldier by his side. The deck was slick with blood in places. My stomach turned as I remembered the horror of the battle. A Corporal Guy Healer was tending to the wounded. Where was Mal? There were soldiers and Grisha standing by the railings, bloodied, singed, and considerably fewer in number than when we had set out. They were all watching me warily. With growing fear, I realized that the soldiers and the Korporalnik were actually guarding me, like a prisoner. I said, "Mal Oretsev, he's a tracker. He was injured during the attack. Where is he?" No one said anything. "Please," I begged, "where is he?" There was a jolt as the skiff came aground. The captain gestured at me with his rifle. "Up!" I thought about simply refusing to get up until they told me what had happened to Mal, but a glance at the heartrender made me reconsider. I got to my feet, wincing at the pain in my shoulder. Then I stumbled as the skiff started to move again, pulled forward by the dry dock workers on land. Instinctively, I reached out to steady myself, but the soldier I touched shrank back from me as if burned. I managed to find my footing, but my thoughts were reeling. The skiff halted again.
"Move,"
the captain commanded. The soldiers led me at rifle point from the skiff. I passed the other survivors, acutely aware of their curious and frightened stares, and caught sight of the senior cartographer babbling excitedly to a soldier. I wanted to stop and tell him what had happened to Alexei, but I didn't dare. As I stepped onto the dry dock, I was surprised to see that we were back in Kribirsk. We hadn't even made it across the fold. I shuddered. Better to be marching through camp with a rifle at my back than to be on the unsea. But not much better, I thought anxiously. As the soldiers marched me up the main road, people turned from their work to gawk. My mind was worrying, searching for answers and finding nothing. Had I done something wrong in the fold? Broken some kind of military protocol? And how had we gotten out of the fold anyway? The wounds near my shoulder throbbed. The last thing I remembered was the terrible pain of the Volcra's claws piercing my back. That searing burst of light. How had we survived?
These thoughts were driven from my mind as we approached the officer's tent. The captain called the guards to a halt and stepped toward the entrance. The Korporalnik reached out a hand to stop him.
This is a waste of time. We should proceed immediately to...
Take your hand off me, bloodletter,
the captain snapped and shook his arm free. For a moment, the Korporalnik stared at him, her eyes dangerous. Then she smiled coldly and bowed.
Da, Capitan.
I felt the hair on my arms rise. The captain disappeared inside the tent. We waited. I glanced nervously at the Korporalnik, who had apparently forgotten her feud with the captain, and was scrutinizing me once again. She was young, maybe even younger than I was, but that hadn't stopped her from confronting a superior officer. Why would it? She could kill the captain where he stood without ever raising a weapon. I rubbed my arms, trying to shake the chill that had settled over me. The tent flap opened, and I was horrified to see the captain emerge, followed by a stern Colonel Ravsky. What could I possibly have done that would require the involvement of a senior officer? The colonel peered at me, his weathered face grim.
What are you?
Assistant cartographer Alina Starkov, Royal Corps of Surveyors. He cut me off.
What are you?
I blinked. I'm a mapmaker, sir. Ravsky scowled. He pulled one of the soldiers aside and muttered something to him that sent the soldier sprinting back toward the dry docks.
Let's go,
he said tersely. I felt the jab of a rifle barrel in my back and marched forward. I had a very bad feeling about where I was being taken. It can't be, I thought desperately. It makes no sense. But as the huge black tent loomed larger and larger before us, there could be no doubt about where we were headed. The entrance to the Grisha tent was guarded by more Korporalki Heartrenders and charcoal-clad Oprichniki, the elite soldiers who made up the Darkling's personal guard. The Oprichniki weren't Grisha, but they were just as frightening. The Korporalnik from the skiff conferred with the guards at the front of the tent, then she and Colonel Ravsky disappeared inside. I waited, my heart racing, aware of the whispers and stares behind me, my anxiety rising. High above, four flags fluttered in the breeze. Blue, red, purple, and above them all, black. Just last night, Mal and his friends had been laughing about trying to get into this tent, wondering what they might find inside. And now it seemed I would be the one to find out. Where is Mal? The thought kept returning to me, the only clear thought I seemed to be able to form. After what seemed like an eternity, the Korporalnik returned and nodded at the captain, who led me into the Grisha tent. For a moment, all my fear disappeared, eclipsed by the beauty that surrounded me. The tent's inner walls were draped with cascades of bronze silk that caught the glimmering candlelight from chandeliers sparkling high above. The floors were covered in rich rugs and furs. Along the walls, shimmering silken partitions separated compartments where Grisha clustered in their vibrant kefta. Some stood talking. Others lounged on cushions, drinking tea. Two were bent over a game of chess. From somewhere I heard the strings of a balalaika being plucked. The Duke's estate had been beautiful, but it was a melancholy beauty of dusty rooms and peeling paint, the echo of something that had once been grand. The Grisha tent was like nothing I had ever seen before. A place alive with power and wealth. The soldiers marched me down a long carpeted aisle, at the end of which I could see a black pavilion on a raised dais. A ripple of curiosity spread through the tent as we passed. Grisha men and women stopped their conversations to gape at me. A few even rose to get a better look. By the time we reached the dais, the room was all but silent, and I felt sure that everyone must hear my heart hammering in my chest. In front of the black pavilion, a few richly attired ministers were wearing the king's double eagle, and a group of corporalki clustered around a long table spread with maps. At the head of the table was an ornately carved high-backed chair of blackest ebony, and upon it lounged a figure